voters that they start looking for in their state senator.
You are 10:15. You have him right. We'll call the House Tax Committee to order when we actually have a quorum. Members, just a quick announcement here before we get going. You know, normally we hear bills and lay more for possible inclusion. However, we've notified members that House File 2515, a Smith bill regarding some probate provisions, we will be putting up for a vote to refer to the General Register. So just a heads up, if there's any issues you want to look at on that one, I don't want to blindside anybody here. Okay, so with that, we have a Fabian bill. The question is, do we have a Fabian?
Good bill.
Okay, we will go to item next. We will go to a Pew bill, House File 2868. And for the authors, when we do have a quorum, we will be breaking in to officially call a meeting to order. So, Representative Pugh, welcome to the Tax Committee. I can see that we've done appropriate things here. You can just, you may approach the bench. Yes, just let's get right to the point here. Oh, they look delicious. They look good there. They're approved. Okay, thank you. Okay, we sure want to give a favorable hearing to this bill. I mean, a hearing to this bill. Okay, House File 2868. When we have a quorum, Representative Pugh, I will move it. I see that there is no amendments at this point. We should have a revenue note. Kind of. Okay. Okay, so with that, welcome to the committee. And so if you could please, let's see here. When we have a quorum, I'll move House File 2868, be there for possible inclusion. So if you please present your bill, Representative Pugh.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chair Davids and committee, for hearing House File 2688. I'm really excited about this bill, which offers a financial incentive to dental providers who offer free and or discounted services to veterans. And in the interest of time, I have just one testifier here. Who is a member of, it's a part of a class that has been involved in every step of the way in the legislative process. So we'll hear from Ryan in a moment. I'm not sure who has learned more at this point. The students from a political science class at Concordia University right here in St. Paul, or me, a second-term state representative. So in early February, I received a call from one of the students, Joshua Coyne, who informed me that Concordia was one of Minnesota's yellow ribbon or veteran-friendly campuses, and that his class, which included a number of veterans, had an idea for a bill. They'd researched members looking for one who was passionate about helping veterans and students, and they reached out to me. The students and I got to work right away, and I'm so grateful. We're all so grateful for all the support we received, including from Ben Johnson of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm not sure if Ben is here today, but I'm so grateful to him and to so many others. The students presented their idea at the monthly convening of the Military Action Group, which maybe you've heard referred to as MAG. In February, they received input, support, and encouragement from many in attendance, and responded by continuing their work right up to and through their spring break at Concordia. Our first draft revisions included tweaking the thresholds for the SSAP, which is the State Soldiers Assistance Program, making it more accessible to veterans, like one of the students in Ryan's class. And it included an appropriation originally of $2 million. However, the realities of a short session, this not being a budget year, and the fact that tweaking an established program like the SSAP, which members who aren't familiar with it, grants benefits to dependents of veterans in housing, optical, education, hearing aids, and more, all in addition to dental, was not going to be simple or realistic this session. So that resulted in us taking our bill in a completely different direction. So we amended the bill to remove any reference to SSAP, and we removed the $2 million appropriation. But we added a provision for charity care so that any of the over 4,000 dental providers practicing within the state who are willing to provide services to veterans at no charge or at a discounted rate which I believe there are going to be many. In fact, I don't really know at this point how many of those over 4,000 providers of dental services are, in fact, veterans themselves. But I'm just very optimistic that this is going to be a successful program. So they'll receive tax credits, technically a subtraction, for doing so. And the program will be managed through our outstanding and somewhat unique as a state Veterans Service Officers Program, of which our counties each have at least one. So members, that in essence is my bill. It's a really good bill. And Mr. Chairman, if I could ask for my testifier to offer a few remarks.
Yes, and members, we do have a quorum, so I'll officially call the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Simonson moves the minutes of April 14th. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Simonson moves the minutes of April 15th, 2016. Any additions or corrections?
Oh, excuse me.
Chair Erickson.
Representative Simonson was not present at that meeting. Remember, you couldn't approve the meetings because he wasn't here, so I'm not sure that you want to keep your rolling standard going, but that is a question.
Thank you, and thank you for bringing that to our attention, Chair Erickson. We have no rules in this committee, so all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chair Erickson. Okay, we are very fortunate to have with us today. Now, I have to think, I haven't looked anything up, but you are a golden bear, not a cobber. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Golden bears. Okay. Okay, so please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir. But excuse me. Is there anyone else wish to testify on behalf of this bill? Is there anyone that wish to testify with concerns? Okay, that should shorten up the testimony. Is there any comments from the department on this bill? Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Okay, so please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Chairman Davids and committee members. I am Ryan Olson. Thank you for the privilege of testifying on House File 2868. We are incredibly proud of this bill. As students for over the last 6 months, we have researched every possible angle to find a solution to emergency dental care for veterans, especially student veterans, after knowing what happened to my classmate, Hank Goff. Hank is a recent veteran after serving 4 years with the U.S. Marine Corps and was just recipient of the Disney Sports Spirit Character Award on ESPN. Today we are discussing our legislative proposal and ensures veterans have access to emergency dental care. When Hank was serving on a tour in 2010-2011, he received a military dental care for a simple filling. Hank received an honorable discharge and enrolled in Concordia University. This November, while playing football, that same tooth rotted due to insufficient military dental care. Hank, while in the classroom, suddenly found himself with a massive infection, face swelling to double the normal size. Unknown to all of us, only veterans with 100% service-connected disability didn't qualify for dental insurance. Hank instead found himself visiting the dentist, being told he had two options: pay $6,000 for a root canal or pull his tooth for $1,000. As a full-time student-athlete, you can imagine his checkbook balance. He lives on ramen. You can imagine his shock when he saw the $6,000 bill. After weeks in pain and missing class, Hank's options were limited and he had the tooth pulled. He told our professor and our class about his experience and lack of dental coverage. We have spent the last 5 months since researching other dental programs in Minnesota. Minnesota's current veteran options are limited, so we have proposed a solution to service members, all veterans, past, present, and future. According to Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs in 2014, Minnesota has 369,000 veterans, including 15,000 student veterans, like my two classmates. With our legislation, we could make a lasting difference for all those veterans, especially the ones in need. The willingness of Minnesota veterans to sacrifice for our country has earned them our last gratitude. Here we have American heroes that can't even get a root canal without breaking the bank. We thank Representative Pugh and Senator Anderson for being our chief authors and working with us to find a reasonable solution. Our legislation does 3 points. One, requires the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs to identify dental professionals who are willing to provide free or reduced fee dental services to veterans. requires the commissioner to make these providers aware of the tax subtraction in Section 2. 2 creates a tax subtraction for dental health care providers who provide free or discounted dental care to veterans. And 3 makes conforming changes to the alternative minimum tax statute that reflects the tax subtraction in Article 2. Thank you, Chairman. It's time to give our veterans the benefits they deserve. We're ready for any questions.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Olson from members? It's pretty straightforward. Okay, I will renew my motion at House File 2860. Or do you have a question?
No, Mr. Chair, I was just going to make a comment that it's always so good when we have our college students step up and really find out what happens around here and prepare so thoroughly a piece of legislation.
Thank you, Chair. Some other comments? Chair Dabney.
thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for staff, if I may.
Certainly.
This creates a tax subtraction for dental care providers who do charity care, specifically targeting veterans in this case. Aren't they already able to deduct the value of charity care from their business taxes? Can you help me understand that, Mr.
Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, no, they're not, because basically the only way you can deduct essentially property or services that you provide to someone is if you've already taken that into income, and in this case, basically what the provider is doing is foregoing income, and so standard tax policy principles would say you're getting sort of a deduction that it's almost like a double deduction, because the value of the services have not been reflected in the provider's income, and so they're not allowed to deduct essentially the foregone income that they get from not charging for those services. So this would be, an extraordinary deduction, and that's why you need to enact a law to do it. It's just a standard rubric that you can't, like if you volunteer your services as a non-professional, you cannot say, gee, my time is worth $15 an hour, and so I've worked at the food shelf, and I'm going to deduct $15 for every hour that I work. That's not allowable, and that would be the equivalent if this were allowable under current law.
Chair Dabney.
Learn something new every day, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, with that, I'll renew my motion. House File 2868 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus tax bill. Item next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Representative Pugh and Mr. Olson. We will now go to House File 3377.
Joel, on this one. This state.
So there'd be no incentive for a veteran to purchase, even if he could afford it.
Okay, I will move House File 3377, and we will not be voting on this. I will now move the H3377A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like, and then we will not need to do the A2 amendment. Is that correct, Representative Fabian?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so I will move the H3377A3 amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill in the order that the author would like, and members, the A2 amendment we're not going to be acting on. So, Representative Fabian, if you could please present your bill to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'll try to be brief, but I do want to preface my comments by saying that one of the things that I've been asked by my constituents to work on is workforce housing. And I don't think it's any surprise to anybody that it is one of the things that I have tried to respond to. And this House File 3377, I view as another tool in the toolbox, you might say, for local people to deal with the workforce housing issue that affects a large part of Minnesota, and particularly northwestern Minnesota. What we've done with the A3 amendment is we've changed the effective date of the bill to 2018. We're allowing cities and Indian tribes to take advantage of this fund. and then also allows for a carryover within the biennium. And then it allows for grants or loans to be made up to $1 million per applicant. This affordable homeownership development program that we want to establish at Minnesota Housing Finance is one that we want to try to address the concerns with regards to home ownership. And I can't thank members of the House who have signed on to the bill enough. They recognize the need for this, and this is a good bill to try to get at some of those issues. The bill itself allows for development costs, rehab. You know, on many main streets in rural Minnesota, just on March 1st in Badger, Minnesota, there's a former, what used to be a church that burned down. And they used, you know, that's a rehab type thing where you're able to go in and convert a building using maybe a program, something like this. So this can be used for multifamily ownership, single family ownership. The beauty of this bill is it's very, very flexible. And it allows for a lot of individual needs or wants at the local level in this program. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to our testifier.
Okay. I have Anastasia Belladonna Carrera, and I have on the list Jeff Corey and Kevin Walker. Are there other folks that wish to testify on behalf of this bill? Yeah. Are there folks who wish to testify with concerns on the bill? Does the department, Mr. Cummings, wish to weigh in? Okay. Okay, so with that, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
My name is Jeff Corey. I'm with One Roof Community Housing from Duluth, Minnesota, and I'm representing the coalition of folks that are working on the Workforce Homeownership Minnesota bill.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you kindly. I have a slightly awkward thing to kick off with here. I'm legally blind, so if I pull the readers up, it gets worse. But I won't be able to recognize you by your nameplates or whatnot. And if I pass you in the hall after, I'm a real friendly person. I just won't know who you are. So I'd like to let
folks know that. We'll help you out with that, Mr. Corey. What part? You live in Duluth?
I live in Duluth, sir.
What part?
In Lakeside at present. I lived in the Endion neighborhood previously. For about 20 years in the Endion neighborhood.
Oh, Duluth East Greyhounds?
That's the school.
Awesome. Do you remember, and you're maybe too young, but in 1969 you had a state championship basketball team, and you had Como Pontliano was kind of the, what is it, like 6 foot 90? Oh, he was, sorry. Sorry.
Central.
They were state champs, right? Okay. I stand corrected. Okay, Mr. Corey, to the bill.
1969 was a really good year for me, actually. It was the year I believe I was conceived. So,
so you were born in 1970. Born in 1970? Yes. This, we might want to get back to the bill. Mr. Corey.
Sometimes you just have to pick the piece of fruit there, sorry. We're here to talk about the challenge of homeownership across the state, both outside the metro and in the metro. We're all aware that a combination of rising costs, rising values, lack of supply, in some places appraisals not penciling out to work for what the costs of the housing cost to produce, are just creating it increasingly a hard time for folks in the workforce to be able to join in the homeownership community. We often talk about the American dream, right, is owning a house. A few years back, I drew the short straw and was talking to a group of Cub Scouts in Duluth about affordable homeownership, interestingly enough. And this group of kids were suddenly joined by their parents, and I did a lot of thinking about how do you talk to kids about this, and I thought I had a good strategy, and then their parents were there, and when I was speaking to them, I realized that the strategy works for the parents as well as the kids. So, you know, a simple show of hands can tell us a lot. Who owns their own home that's in this room? Who grew up in a house that was owned by their parents? Who had a pet? Who had a garden?
Sometimes.
Who had a swing set? Do your kids have all of those things? your grandkids have all of those things, if you have grandkids. That's what we're talking about when we talk about homeownership, is the ability to put down roots and participate in a community in a different way, in a longer-term way. And so that's the context that I'd like you to think about, what homeownership for the workforce brings to people that this bill would help. One Roof Community Housing, where I work, does a broad range of housing services, from home buyer education and counseling on the one end to development of homeownership on the other, lending to help people fix up their homes in the middle. The coalition that we're working with is, as I said before, a broad group that represents nonprofits from around the state, including the metro, and they're made up of community action agencies, other community development groups, all working, and manufactured housing, all working to try to help folks have a bit of the American dream of owning their own homes. This group happens to produce the vast majority of homeownership units that the state invests in with the super request for proposals annually. We do a really good job of serving minority homeowners. We typically serve 2 to 4 times as many percentage-wise minority owners in our communities as live there. In our community, we served last year just over 1/3 of the folks we served were minority homeowners, and our minority population is a little bit below 10%. Specifics about the bill, this would supplement other Minnesota housing resources, so it would help us do more. Specifically, we think it would help us do about twice as much homeownership development in a year. As Representative Fabian said previously, it's a flexible source that would help with meeting local needs, depending on what they are. In my community, there's a lot of need for both new housing but also fixing up housing. We have the oldest housing stock in the state. It also could work for infrastructure, for new manufactured housing communities, or for replacing such things. It could be used by cities, housing authorities, economic development authorities, tribes, and nonprofits to bring about these new homeownership units and fixed up homeownership units. It's important to understand that the bulk of the work that would happen, however, would be with local contractors and vendors and suppliers. So it's not, it really will be a generator in the local economy as well. The vast majority of the state investment in housing in recent history has gone to rental housing. As I said before, this would double homeownership production. And no one in our coalition has anything against rental housing. It's a very important part of the spectrum of housing needs in the community, but we'd like to see some more folks have a shot at the American dream of owning their own home. Income limits, as currently proposed, would max out at between $89,000 and $99,500 for the program, depending on the place that you're using it. We think we could do about 200 more new units a year and about 50 rehabs. I mentioned those numbers because what I'll close with is to talk about the return on investment beyond just the new homeownership units. But the calculation on return on investment was based on the 200 new units and 50 rehab units. We believe that this would create about $3 million in state tax sales in state tax revenue, a combination of sales tax, income tax, and the mortgage and deed registration tax. We think it would drive about 700 jobs to be created through the construction process. We think there would be about $2.7 million in realtor commissions generated from this. The bulk of our organizations that create these affordable homes participate in the multiple listing services in their respective communities. Mine does as well. Again, this benefits local contractors, vendors, manufactured housing companies, and it would also help increase the local tax base by adding more homeownership units to the community. That's the end of my remarks. Happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Mr. Corey. Any questions for Mr. Corey? Chair Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if you could go, I'd like him to expand, Mr. Corey, on page 1 under use of funds number 4. It says at the end of the sentence, storm shelters and community facilities. And my question is, and maybe if Mr. Corey doesn't know the answer, staff might, but don't we already, if you're developing, and I assume we're talking manufactured housing there, if you're developing a manufactured housing park, at any rate, doesn't current law require that you provide storm shelters and so on?
Ms. Manzi or Mr. Michael?
As part of the park development is right. What I'm asking.
Yes. I think the answer is yes. Mr. Chair, the answer is yes.
Okay, Chair Carlson.
Well, then, if we already require it and you're developing a park, I'm just trying to sort this through, then why we would be using the funds for that purpose if the developer would be doing it anyway, because we have limited funds, and if then that would probably mean more residential housing being developed if they're already required to provide the storm shelter as a part of the development. If you could comment
Carlson,
on that.
I believe that
Mr. Corey?
Sorry. I believe that a significant part of the manufactured housing that may be created from this would be in resident-owned communities, so where the residents actually owned the lots as a group and the bulk of the park. And so they would, if that community was going to be created, part of the cost of creating it would be those shelters, which are, by law, as you rightly point out, required to exist.
Chair Carlson. Well, Mr. Chair, maybe that explains it then if the land is owned by the, you know, I was reading into it kind of what the historical tradition has been, you know, a developer goes in and develops a mobile home park or whatever the appropriate term may be these days, manufactured housing park, that they were required to do that. But then that's usually, as we learned the other day when we had the bill up about people who were looking for funds or an increase in the fund to help people move when a park is being redeveloped because they don't own the land. My other question, Mr. Chairman, is how will this interact then with what we heard the other day from the folks from Albert Lea? Does this bill cover that situation as well if you were to move forward with this one, or would there still be a need for the Albert Lea proposal?
Mr. Michael? Well, if Mr. Michael doesn't know, I don't feel so bad.
But, Mr. Chairman,
no,
maybe that's
very good question because we, you know, does,
yeah.
Do you know Representative Fabian? We had a bill here regarding Albert Lea housing, and if we did this, would we need that? Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, or Carlson, that tax credit is targeted toward rental housing, and I don't think owner-occupied housing would qualify under it, whereas this proposal is available for home ownership, because if you look, it's for workforce and affordable home ownership development. So it's, I think the two would be viewed as complementary, not substitutes for one another. Sorry, I wasn't thinking of that other bill as an Albert Lea bill, and so I didn't compute for me what you were referring to.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as we know, housing and the Albert Lea one, then I guess with rental and this one shows there's a huge need. I was just wondering how the bills would interact, so it looks like they would be serving a separate or distinctly different service. So thank you.
Questions for Mr. Corey? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Corey, this is just a follow-up question because I'm not sure I see it anywhere. Is there any kind of guideline as to the square footage of a family home in regards to the needs?
Mr. Corey?
You know, I don't believe there are guidelines within the MHFA programs presently for that.
Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's one of the critical things that we need continue to look at is there are a lot of young people that think they need to have a huge house to live in as well, and we need to also help everyone understand what can be classified as a home and what can be made into a very, very good home. As a member of a family of five that grew up in a house that had less than 900 square feet, now it can be done very well for the smaller ones too if that's the direction we have. And when we're talking about government involvement, I think we need to also help people understand that the decisions we make are also very important. And so thank you for your testimony.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, of the 800 cities in Minnesota, I bet half of them would say they have a shortage of both workforce and affordable housing. And so one of the things that I didn't note in the proposal before us is any detail on how the selections would be made, the prioritization of need. You know, it basically has two lines. It says the commissioner is going to consult with some interested stakeholders and then develop the guidelines. And, you know, it seems to me that when we're going to put just a small amount of money into a huge demand, we need to have a much clearer statement of legislative purpose and a focusing of those things. I mean, I like the idea of community land trusts and programs where the affordability is recycled through generations of those homeowners, as opposed to our typical housing redevelopment programs where it goes to, you know, whoever wins the lottery gets the new house, and then as it appreciates, they transfer the wealth to their heirs, but the community still has an affordable housing shortage. And so I'm really concerned about taking money from our general fund that's inadequate to meet the need, and then having some totally putting the responsibility on the commissioner to come up with some kind of guidelines for a program that won't begin to start to respond to the dreams of all those 800 plus cities or 400 plus cities, however would approach this. And can you tell me a little bit about why you kept it as vague as you did in terms of priorities or selection?
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and I know that Corey wants to respond to this too, but I think in my opening comments, one of the things that I mentioned attracted me to this is because of the flexibility that's built into it. And the direction at MHFA within the program that's going to be established is established in working with different people, different groups, communities who are interested in solving problems with regards to that. So to be, I'll say, overly prescriptive here through the legislative process would probably make this less attractive to me. I have a lot of trust in people in my district who are struggling with these issues, whether it's in Rosa or Thief River Falls or Greenbush. You know, I have a lot of confidence in them being able to put the parameters in place that work for them, and hopefully working through this process with the commissioner's staff, they can come up with the procedures that are needed so that you can deal with things on an individual basis in different communities.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually think when we're going to start what I consider kind of a pilot program, it needs to have some kind of focused outcomes and goals that we could actually assess it against, and also to target the resources to where we think the greatest need is, rather than leaving it to a state agency that, you know, really doesn't get any guidance from us on what they should do. And, I mean, it'd be, in some ways, it's giving a pretty big burden to them in terms of trying to figure out how to target it and being, you know, second-guessed in that process. The other thing is, I'm wondering if you have the income was mentioned as like $89,000 to $100,000 a year, which I think our median income is $61,000 per household, so that's significant. And in some areas of the state, that's the highest paid people in town. In other places, that's sort of a more average sort of earning. And I don't see any kind of variability based on the economic circumstances of the area. And could you address that?
Mr. Colby? Corey.
Thank you. So, two thoughts in response to your remarks, Representative Loeffler. First, relative to your first comment, there is an anticipation that the same sort of strings that exist on investments that the state makes in homeownership would prevail and be part of this program as well. And so that could range from community land trust works, housing. Our organization has done nearly 300 of those homes to date, to housing for folks that are a bit higher income, up to 115% of very median income. In those cases, there would be, I'm sorry, my brain just stopped working for a moment, but a second mortgage on the home, and the funds would be repaid in the event of a resale or a refinance. And so the funds would be protected in that regard in most all cases, I believe. relative to the different incomes, you know, one of the things that I would say that from our perspective the state has done a pretty good job of is understanding the needs in a community, and it is tricky for a community to sort of articulate those needs. It's a sophisticated process that, you know, just as you're understanding the differences in the communities, when MHFA makes decisions about the funding, they have to have a case presented to them that conveys those subtleties and differences in the communities and explains why that particular workforce needs the housing that it needs and why it needs what's being proposed.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have concerns about potentially funding really nice houses for the highest paid people in a town as opposed to where they're and relationship to the demand. And I think we're going to ask our housing finance agency to make a lot of choices. I really prefer to see this come out of the housing committee with an appropriation, and then they're going to provide the oversight that we as the tax committee generally don't provide when we provide these kind of tax benefits over time, because they're the ones who really know what's going on across the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. I have a list here, but I think let's get all the testimony presented first, and then everyone on the list will. So if you could stick around, who would like to go next? Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please. And welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Anastasia Belladonna Carrera. I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. I'd like to firstly thank the committee for the opportunity to be heard on as to this matter of home ownership. In Minnesota, home ownership rate among white households is about 77.5%. While the rate among households of color is just at about 38.2%, it's a gap of roughly 39.3%. A comparison of individual racial and ethnic groups to white households reveals greater variation. Mr. Corey did a really good job, previous to my coming to the table, of kind of creating that larger picture of the challenge for home ownership. I'm here to provide more of a specific lens with regards to this issue as it pertains to our Latino Minnesotans, especially in the greater Minnesota area. Minnesota's home roughly to about 255,000 to 270,000 Latino Minnesotans. About two-thirds of that population lives within the Twin Cities, and a third lives within the rural Minnesota, greater Minnesota area. Mexican households particularly are the group with the least medium earnings of full-time year-round workers ages 16 to 64 as compared to all other minority groups and their white counterparts. Some of the barriers that are faced by our Latino Minnesotans in rural Minnesota is with regards to getting the financial literacy component of it, some of knowing how to tap into the banking system and so forth, and all of that, of course, folds into the challenges faced in home ownership. Part of what you heard with regards to Representative Loeffler's concerns is something that we also share, and we will be following this bill very closely as well as with MFHA and how they decide to move forward with it. Latino Minnesotans, as I had mentioned before, has a unique needs and wants with regards to home ownership. I already alluded to some of the ones that are here new because they're drawn here to jobs and so forth. The concern in our greater Minnesota, southern Minnesota particular region, is with regards to the work shortage. And when I'm out in southern Minnesota meeting with some of those larger pockets of our rural Minnesotans in Faribault, in Mankato, in Rochester, and in Worthington, some of the things I hear from both the business communities as well as our Latino communities is affordable housing for them. There's a shortage of that, and home ownership is a vehicle to address that in a sense. Again, noting some of the very same concerns that Representative Loeffler mentioned at the table, I'll move on to say that with regards to Latino Minnesotans, as you all know, they're drawn there primarily because of the agricultural meatpacking and canning industries that draw them to the area. Affordable home ownership is very limited in greater Minnesota areas and non-existent in others. The lack of housing for Latino Minnesotans is having a negative impact on greater Minnesota businesses. And again, these are jobs that we're not replacing anyone locally, therefore the work shortage, as I'm sure many of you are already aware of, but these are jobs that local individuals are not wanting to take on because they're very labor intensive. The issues that we're seeing repeatedly, which I believe this bill does address in a sense, and that's why I'm here to inform the committee with regards to these dynamics, is with regards to predatory practices that are taking place in southern Minnesota with regards to the very limited rental units that are there. Now, our average salary in the southern Minnesota area for a household, depending on how you define that, is going to be around $48,000 at most. Again, flagging some of the concerns that I noted earlier. We will be following this bill. We'll be following actions taken by MHFA and working, of course, with that agency as well in addressing some of these needs, coming back to the Capitol in 2017 and reminding members of the committee what outcomes were or were not with regards to Latinos in Minnesota. We do believe, however, in general, that House File 3371 does address some of the core needs faced by our Latino Minnesotans, albeit as small as they are, in the lack of affordable housing in that area, and we do encourage the committee to move it forward.
Thank you very much. Let's go to the next testifier, and if Mr. Corey and ma'am, if you could stick around, because we've got a list of questions here. Who was next? There was a Kevin Walker. Okay, we'll go to member questions then. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just kind of looking for some clarification what would happen with this bill, so maybe staff could help us with what would happen when there's perhaps a housing downturn and the MRT or the state deed tax is less than the previous year. What would happen to these grants and programs that would be established?
Ms. Manzi or Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in that year, the way the bill works is that the increase over the previous fiscal year is what's appropriated. And so if collections are flat or if they decline, there would be no appropriation in those years. So the program would receive no additional funding.
Thank you for that. And then the distribution of the excess deed tax and mortgage tax, does that just go out statewide, or is that, would it make more sense to have it redistributed within the county that it's paid in? Perhaps that would be more equitable.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
That could be the Kosnick Amendment, I guess, but that's certainly not something that that I had anticipated here. I think that you've got the little chart just referring back to the tax and so forth and how it's growing and projected to grow. I'm not prepared to deal with that at this point, Representative Kosnick. Thank you.
Representative Kosnick. Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Fabian. You know what I think of this bill, and I align with Representative Loeffler really well. I think this is a bad bill. I think.
Well, Chair Drazkowski, she didn't say it was a bad bill.
Oh, that was my interpretation, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay, Chair Drazkowski.
I did, Mr.
That's
Chair.
A liberal interpretation. You said that.
I did, Mr. Chair. Okay. Yeah. So we got both sides of the coin covered, maybe, Mr. Chair. So I heard Mr. Corey talking and about the American dream. And, you know, members, as I think about the American dream, I think about the pride in work that goes forward as people work to achieve their own home and work to put aside the money to do the down payment, to pay the bills over time, to pay off the bank and own their own home and be liberated. That's what I understand to be the American dream. What we have here is a bill that has a government by the House or a portion of the House for people, ostensibly paid for by taxpayers who have money taken away from them at the force of government in order to buy it for somebody else. And we continue to go in this direction as we find and believe that government is going to be the solution to our answers and place government in the center of all decisions. And that's the part that troubles me most, Representative Fabian, about this bill. But I have a question that's specific, and that is there's a flyer in front of us called the Workforce Homeownership Minnesota, and I'm curious who this organization is. It's a special interest organization of some sort, apparently, and who funds them, that type of thing. Where do you get your money, sir?
Well, first of all, Chair Drazkowski, we'll put you down as a maybe on this bill. Mr. Corey, to the Drazkowski question.
The coalition that produced the flyer is a loosely organized group of community development practitioners from around the state. We aren't funded to do this. We're trying to work together across the state to join forces to further the cause of helping folks have the opportunity to own a home of their own.
Chairman Drazkowski.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Corey. So, you know, and as we see this off in the legislature, we have people coming forward supporting this bill who are going to be then themselves in the middle of or in the center of seeing it to fruition and ostensibly benefiting their work and the activities that they do normally in their work career. And we see this, in Mr. Corey, it's not just you or this bill. It happens here every day, and it's just good to know what we have in front of us here with this flyer. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Drazkowski. Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Corey, what's a community land trust as it would be defined in this bill?
Mr. Corey?
A community land trust is typically a nonprofit organization that maintains ownership of land under housing that it sells to particular residents in a community. Generally, those residents, there are some income limits around it. For our organization, just to give you a little bit more perspective, the average median income buyer of someone in some neighborhoods of Duluth is about probably 50% of their median income. Other neighborhoods, it approaches 80% of their median income. And we're talking about trying to create some homeownership opportunities for the workforce in Grand Marais. And for that particular community, it looks like we'll be serving folks up to 115% of their median income because that's what the workforce is requiring.
Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Corey, the grants would go to nonprofits, cooperatives, or community land trusts, I think is what I read in the bill. So is this like a pass-through? So the grants go to those, and then you find the builder, and the builder builds the house? You know, how does all that work?
Mr. Corey?
In addition to the groups that you mentioned, it could also go to cities, economic development authorities, housing authorities, and tribal governments. The funds would come to those entities to be used in the development or rehabilitation of homeownership. And typically, the companies that would do the construction work would be contractors from the local community.
Chair Erickson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I did hear something that's of concern to me. If these go to tribal governments, as you just mentioned, how would that work? Because that's a government outside of our state purview. And they own property communally, so I don't quite understand that concept. Can you explain that?
Mr. Corey?
I don't have a lot of background in that area. I think it would probably be best for someone from Minnesota Housing to respond if possible, or someone else from the state, but it's my understanding that presently tribal governments are able to apply to the state for funding, so it wouldn't be a change of practice.
Chair Erickson?
I'll talk offline, Mr. Chair, because they wouldn't pay mortgage or deed taxes for sure, because the government owns the housing. That's most interesting.
Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know who can answer this question, but I'm looking on page 1, line 21 of the bill, and it says that the grant funds could be awarded to residential housing, including storm shelters and community facilities. I'm just curious, what is a community facility? And are we just building a I'll let you, if you want to give a response to that.
Well, isn't it a soccer stadium, Representative Fabian? Representative Fabian. To
thank
the Anderson
Chair.
Question.
Yes. The community facilities is referring to the manufactured home facilities. It's not, a soccer stadium or something like that. So, and then the shelter that would be there would be in a manufactured home area park that would be, you know, there's a state statute, I believe we talked about that earlier, that requires that the storm shelters be there if you just have the one level.
Chair Anderson, yes.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, I'm concerned that because it's not clearly defined on what community facilities would mean, that there would be an opportunity for that to be used elsewhere. But I just want to leave you with this as well. I've been a big fan of the mortgage and deed tax in particular, because it's people in my community that wind up paying the bulk of it. And it also is a hindrance to providing affordable housing, because it raises the price of home ownership overall. And in Hennepin County and in Ramsey County, the locals also institute their own mortgage and deed tax. So it further increases the price of home ownership and puts that dream for everybody further away. So those are the concerns that I have. I understand what you're trying to do, but I would be happy to work with you maybe in some other ways of trying to achieve that goal without increasing the price of home ownership.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and to Representative Anderson and Representative Drazkowski and lots of members, I understand the concern that many people have, and I have some of those myself. But the role the government has played, too, in housing has actually created some barriers to doing some of the things. And again, I go back, this hasn't been in this committee, I don't believe, but the project that we were trying to build locally, privately, in Roseau, you can't do it unless you have just a tremendous amount of wealth that you want to put into it. A $3.4 million 30 or 40-unit apartment complex, you can only borrow 80% of the appraised value, and the appraisal is based on the market rate that they're charging for the housing, which at that time in Roseau was about $650. But to build something new, now you got to charge $950 to make it cash flow, and you can't do it. So you take out a second mortgage on your motel or your other business. I recognize those, and I'm happy to work with Representative Anderson and Drazkowski and any members to try to deal with these things. So I appreciate the opportunity to present to the committee, and I'm happy to answer any more questions.
Chair Davney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Fabian, you'll be pleased to know I'm warmer to this bill than Representative Drazkowski. But that doesn't leave me without a couple of questions. And I'm not quite sure where to begin, but it strikes me that in your example of Roseau, where the market can bear a $650 a month rent, that the fundamental problem that employees are faced in getting housing goes back to their pay. That the employers in Roseau simply are not willing to pay their employees enough to be able to afford housing. And that the bankers then look at the pay that the employees are getting, what percentage of that income can reasonably be dedicated to housing, and they say, doesn't work. And we're seeing more and more examples of employers trying to make their business model work by simply paying people insufficiently or maybe less. We see that the hospitality industry keeps coming back here looking for the opportunity to cut the wages of tipped personnel. We saw this last weekend at Target Field, where Delaware North, the vendor for food and drink at Target Field, decided rather than paying Minnesotans to sell hot dogs and pour beer and the like, they would ship people in from Chicago and Milwaukee and Green Bay, pay them for their travel time, cover the costs of their travel, put them up in a hotel, and then pay them I don't know what to work and take Minnesotans' jobs. How much does it cost Delaware North
to ship people in to take Minnesotans jobs that they could instead be using to pay Minnesotans who could then buy homes. So, Reverend Fabian, isn't the fundamental problem here that Minnesotans aren't making enough money for the work they do for Minnesota companies? Because if they made more, you wouldn't be here with an affordable housing bill for people who make $99,000 a year already?
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, for me, the fundamental problem is there's a shortage of housing. And why we are where we are, that's a matter of discussion that we can have, probably have had for the 5 years that I've been in the legislature. And quite frankly, Representative Dabney, I'm sure we're going to have it for another five and maybe 55 years or maybe even 105 years. What I'm trying to do is to address the concerns of my constituents with this bill and others that might be similar to it or different from it, and try to solve the problem. And I don't know that, you know, I'm not the king. I'm not going to be able to mandate what how people are compensated. That's not my role. But my role is to recognize the needs of my constituents and to respond to their requests for some type of legislative help, and that's what I'm trying to do with this bill. And I understand the philosophical discussion that that we could have, we could. How many hours do we want to have that discussion? How many years?
Did anyone notice the two people back here in the white coats?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was so glad they left that they weren't here for me. I get a little nervous there. Okay, Chair Dabney.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Fabian. Let me move on to just one practical matter for Mr. Corey. If I'm reading this correctly, and if I'm not, somebody will correct me. I'm confident of that. But it looks like this proposal would generate about $20 million. One of the strengths of the proposal is the use of land trusts, whereas Representative Loeffler indicated the public subsidy to the companies and to the homeowners is captured with some sort of a cap on the equity that the homeowner is able to take with them when they sell the home and move on to wherever they move on to. What percentage of that the money's raised and used in this program will be captured and retained for regeneration of further housing?
Mr. Corey?
Clarifier for your question. Do you mean what percentage of funds that come to the program would be preserved specifically with a community land trust type protection or using other mechanisms as well?
Sure.
Mr. Corey, thank you for asking me to clarify. What percentage of the funds going to the program will be retained and recycled in the program as they are with land trusts?
Mr. Corey?
With whatever the mechanism may be.
Representative Fabian?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's the money that would be coming from the mortgage and the deed taxes. It's my understanding that all of those dollars will be going into the housing projects. I can ask MHFA, but I don't believe that they're anticipating administrative costs outside of this.
I'm just not being clear here. Let me try one more time and see if I can. My apologies. This money is going to go into the program. We know that if it goes into a land trust, there are caps on the equity the homeowner can take away, and some percentage of the money going into the program then is retained and recycled into the next generation of homeownership. What I'm trying to understand is of the total dollars going into this program, I understand, you know, MHFA administers and all of that, but of the money that actually goes into creating housing, through whatever mechanism, what percentage of that money will be retained and recycled so that the taxpayer holds the value of the subsidy as they do using the land trust as an example?
Mr. Corey.
I hope that was clearer.
It was, thank you.
It was louder, I know that.
My understanding is that 100% of the funds that go to lower the price of the homes below what their appraised value is would be protected by one mechanism or another. The only instance where there wouldn't be protection, and this is an important thing to remember, particularly for communities with really low property values, is that it's very hard to recapture those dollars, but for a community land trust type one, in those instances, because it may cost $250,000 to build a house, but the values in that community might be really low, and so the difference between that cost and the value is usually given as a grant, if that makes sense.
Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Corey. That was helpful. Thank you, Representative Fabian.
Chairman Knobloch.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. First, Representative Dabney's comments, I guess I don't know why this company chose to bring people from out of state to do the vending, but apparently they must not have been able to find people around here that they felt were qualified to do it. I don't know if they maybe didn't look hard enough or didn't look in the right places or if they just couldn't find people that were available, but in any case, for whatever reason, they made that decision, and it seems like kind of an odd decision for them to have made, but they made it. But I guess my question, Representative Fabian, is, you know, I suspect part of the problem here is in terms of apartment developers. Many of the cities you're talking about are fairly small, fairly remote. I can see a person who might build apartments being reluctant to build an apartment in a town that has one or two very large employers, and when they need to take out a mortgage, they've got to take out a 20 or 25 year mortgage and bet that business is still going to be going strong years from now. Have any of these large employers gone into doing housing themselves? I mean, it seems to me that if I was them and I really had this housing problem, that's something I would consider.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can, you know, in my home community of Roseau, the home of Polaris Industries that was started over 60 years ago by three local men and their families, they have been involved in a partnership, one of the apartment complexes there in town. They've also brought in, I believe it's five or six units that are multi-person units that they have invested in, that are sitting in one of our manufactured home areas, but they're much, much larger than the typical manufactured home. So in my community, yes, they are involved. And I can't address what's going on in Marshall, or not to pick on Representative Swedzinski, but for me, yeah, it is. And it's happening in other communities in Thief River Falls. So the extent to which, I can't address that completely, Chair Knobloch.
Chair Knobloch?
No, thanks.
Okay, members, I have a list here. We'll take a few more, but then we do have two other bills we do need to get to. And then tomorrow during committee, we'll have House File 2020, a Fenton bill, Washington County EDA, House File 3926, a Simonson bill, Duluth High School sales tax exemption, and then House File 2071 of David's, the Department of Revenue's technical bill. Vice Chair Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to discuss the issue of Delaware North, apparently they've had issues hiring at Target Field since last summer. They've been advertising, spending thousands of dollars on advertising, couldn't get anyone, or couldn't get enough people. They have plenty, but they need so many. $12.30 an hour is what they'll pay, and they're part of the union, Local 17 union. And so, you know, I think they should pay more, quite frankly, when they charge so much for a bottle of pop or another beverage. But, you know, that's what it is, $12.30 an hour union jobs. They're bringing in people who are also union employees from employees of Delaware North. And that's the rest of the story, I guess, on that.
Any questions regarding the Fabian bill? Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my comment was more or less Representative Barrett's comment. If you look up the story on WCCO, they have a shortage of applicants, and there's a shortage in several different hospitality areas, so they're just trying to reach out and find people to work for them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ansells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of a confession. I'm leaning toward Representative Drazkowski's view of this legislation. Kind of kind of an unusual shift for me, but and to Representative Knobloch, you know, in the 1900s, the mining companies from Pittsburgh and Cleveland came to the Mesabi to mine the iron ore, and lo and behold, they couldn't get people to take the jobs. They couldn't get people to work in the mine. People would rather work in the woods. They'd make more money, and they wouldn't have to report to somebody from Cleveland or New York or Pittsburgh. Consequently, they engaged in an immigration program. It's the reason why I'm here. It's the reason my family is here. And so people from Europe immigrated here and took the jobs in the mines. And Representative Fabian's problem reared itself there on the Mesabi because the miners didn't have a place to live. But lo and behold, the mining company decided that they were going to build the homes, they were going to build the labor camps, they were going to own the homes, and the miners were going to rent the homes. I was born in one of those homes. The one mistake the mining companies made was in the days of the underground mining, they partnered those of us from Southern and Eastern Europe with the Finns. And the Finns could speak English. And the Finns were writing newspapers. And the Finns told our people, you have to organize. That is the way to get wages commensurate with the value of your labor so you don't have to live in one of these company houses. So Representative Druskowski is absolutely right. Raise the wages, organize the workers.
Since your name was mentioned, Chair Druskowski, you said
Mr. Chair,
like that.
Can this committee offer an award up? I think that award would be the best spin, Representative Anzels, since I've been here. So thank you. I enjoyed it.
I disagree. I think Mr. Cummings did the best job of. That was awesome the other day. Okay. Where am I? Okay.
Tax committee.
they weren't for me. Chair Dabney.
Mr. Chair, maybe first a question for Representative Anzels. Do you want to discuss the role that saunas played in the organizing of on the Iron Range?
Well, first of all, Representative Dabney, there's no such thing as a sauna. It's called a sauna.
A sauna. My apologies.
Chair Dabney.
Yeah, let's not go any further down that path.
That'd be just fine.
But apparently it's a quite a history. Just to wrap up the Delaware North issue, the unemployment rate amongst African Americans in Minnesota is roughly four times the rate of the population as a whole. There's a whole lot of African Americans in North Minneapolis who are looking for jobs, very close to target field. And whatever Delaware North has done is clearly insufficient, and they seem to have forgotten that they're operating at the grace of the taxpayers who own the facility that they're operating in. And whatever they're done is insufficient for their public responsibilities and their business responsibility to reach out and find employees and train them to perform the jobs they need them to do. As we're reaching across the aisle today, you pay enough for a beer and a hot dog for them to do the outreach and the hiring and the training and pay the wages they need, and they can save the money on the buses and the hotel rooms. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, to the Fabian bill. The Vice Chair Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Dabney, let me reach out and throw you an olive branch. What can we do together to link these two very important constituencies together? What can we do? We'll meet afterward. I'll meet all day. Let's get them together so we can get local folks a job at a local institution in which we paid a lot of taxpayer dollars for. So you and I work together. It'll be the Job Caucus.
happy to work with you today, tomorrow, all weekend, next week, whatever it takes, we'll do it.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Dabney.
Well, Representative Barrett, you could sign on to the letter to Speaker Dowd that the Economic Disparities Committee has developed, because the lack of GOP action in this body on economic disparities. There's a number of us who have already signed on to that letter. The work can be done. The hearings are being held. It's the lack of movement by the leadership of this body that's holding it up. So I'll be glad to forward you a copy of the letter, and you can sign on. We can start there.
Vice Chair Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I'm referring to this one issue. We need to solve this issue. This issue does not take Speaker Dowd. It takes two groups of people to get together. We have workers. We have an employer. Let's get them together. We don't need Speaker Dowd for that. You and I can do it together. Let's do it right now.
With that, I'll... Chair Dabney? Okay, I will renew my motion that House File 3377 as amended be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
thank you. And
just so that you know,
what's your bill about again?
I wore my Garcia tie today too, just for you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
And I am a cobber too, so thank you.
Cobber, not a bear cat or golden bear. Doesn't matter. Okay, item next. Thank you, Representative Fabian,
I think.
Okay, I will move House File 2515. Members, we have 2515. I will now move, Representative Smith, is the A3 amendment an author's amendment?
Mr. Chair, it is an author's amendment, yes.
Okay, so I will move House File 2515. I will now move House the amendment H2515A3. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have House File 2515 before the committee as amended. You have one testifier, I believe.
I do, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else wish to testify on behalf? And members, I'm sorry. My motion will be to move House File 2515 as amended to the General Register, as I announced earlier. So is there anyone else wish to testify on behalf of this bill in the audience? Is there anyone wish to testify with concerns? Does Mr. Cummings of the department wish to make any comments on this bill?
Look at this.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Okay, so you have the bill before us. There's nobody against it. It's probate. Please present your bill.
Aye. Mr. Chair, thank you. I hope everyone enjoys freshly baked donuts from one of the best districts in the state while we listen to this very important bill. This bill, Mr. Chair and members, specifically, Section 10 in the bill deals with this committee, and it allows courts to deal with technical mistakes in a last will and testament. And I have Mr. Schuler to provide some brief expert testimony.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jason Schuler, and I'm co-chair of the Probate and Trust Legislative Committee of the Minnesota State Bar Association.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This amendment and the section of this statute really does two things. Currently, we are able to make corrections for tax mistakes and trusts under common law and wills under common law. And then this power is also already available under the new Minnesota Trust Code. And what we're trying to do is tie the probate code and the trust code together and do the same thing. Bill, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for members? Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author or the testifier, and just on the first page here on line 1.10 where it's removing guardianship and conservatorship, and House Research has a little bit of an explanation of how that works, but if you could expound on why that's being deleted.
Representative Smith.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, that issue was dealt with in civil law, and we'd be happy to talk about that in this committee if the chair would allow.
Certainly. Mr. Lake?
Mr. Chairman, we have been discussing this the guardianship matter with legal aid and are working through the differences and hope to resolve them during the summer and then come back to you next session and with amendments to the bill.
Representative Wills?
I suppose I should trust the Civil Law Committee to have vetted that further. I was just curious on the reasoning for it. Thank you.
Well, I would trust but verify. Any other questions? Okay, I'll renew my motion that House File 2515 as amended be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Item last.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, gentlemen. Person of Anderson has House File 3912. And we have an amendment. Is that an author's amendment?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Okay, then Chair Anderson S. moves House File 3912. Chair Anderson S. moves H3912A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill in the shape the author prefers. If you could please present your bill, Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All my bill does is it adds one other way, means of calculating the R&D tax credit. And this would help out some businesses here in the state of Minnesota, but I do have some testifiers if you wish to hear from them.
Are they resources or testifiers?
One is a testifier, and another one could be a resource, but I think he might want to testify as well.
Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of the Chair Anderson S. bill? Anyone with concerns? Does Mr. Cummings for the department wish to make comments on this bill?
No, at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Okay, who would like to go first?
Mr. Chair.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
For the record, John Dukich. I'm with the Minnesota High Tech Association.
Welcome to the committee.
The Minnesota High Tech Association represents more than 300 science and technology companies throughout the state of Minnesota with the goal of helping the state become a top five technology state in the nation. And just to give some background, in 2015, Minnesota's technology industry employed more than 141,000 people, paying an average wage of $93,500. And that's 78% higher than the state's private sector wage. And so having a robust state research and development tax credit is important as we compete with states like California, Texas, and Massachusetts for high-tech, high-paying jobs. And that's why we support strengthening the state's R&D tax credit. I should note that our priority is to see an increase in the second tier of the credit from 2.5% to 4%, and to make the credit refundable. And those provisions or some form of them are included in the omnibus tax bill from last year, and we're hopeful to see positive action on them this year. And the bill before you was brought to MHTA by a member. And as Representative Anderson mentioned, it's an alternative or an elective R&D credit that companies could take advantage of. The proposal does not replace the existing credit, but is an additional option to incentivize R&D in Minnesota. And with that, I can turn it over to Jeff Hyde, who can go into more details on the bill.
Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Chairman Davids, Representative Anderson, and members of the committee. My name is Jeffrey Hyde. I am Senior Tax Counsel for IBM Corporation. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota High Tech Association to discuss House File 3912.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. My purpose is to briefly address the general theory of R&D tax credits and the changes House File 3912 will make to enhance that credit. Also, to give a better understanding, go through the history of the calculation of the existing credit as it is comparable to the federal credit and has not adapted to the changes of the federal as well as other major research development states. The underlying reason or purpose of any R&D incentive is to encourage local investment and employment. An R&D credit is a perfect way to meet those goals since a taxpayer must have in-state operations that conduct research activities locally. I cannot get a Minnesota R&D credit for activities that we conduct outside of the state or offshore. However, it's equally key to recognize that most developed nations and almost every state with an income-based tax now offers R&D incentives. Therefore, if most taxing jurisdictions provide the incentive, the rate of return on research investment must be competitive to encourage investments in Minnesota. Included in that return on investment analysis is the complexity and cost of compliance of the credit. It is much more than just a comparison of the credit rate or the percentage of recovery that provides the best return on investment dollars. House File 3912 will make Minnesota more competitive with other states to provide an R&D credit by simplifying the process. It will allow a taxpayer election to use an alternative calculation method. No one will be forced to change if they do not want to. It reduces a multi-step calculation process currently in place into a few more easily determined calculations. House File 3912 recognizes the changes the federal and other state governments have made to modernize the R&D incentive as a dynamic process. But House File 3912 keeps in place the main component that only R&D activities conducted in Minnesota will be eligible for the credit. Better understand the impact, perhaps, of 3912, it'll be helpful to take a quick look at the current system. As you are aware, in 1982, Minnesota was the first state to enact a statewide federal R&D credit. It modeled after the federal R&D credit, which was enacted in 1981. The Minnesota modeled credit has not changed much in the underlying calculation since its first enactment. Minnesota uses what is referred to as the incremental investment type credit. This merely means that the current year R&D investment must be greater than a base period to demonstrate that there was growth in the process. The theory for this type of credit is the state rewards companies that grow investment activity relative to a set or static base. The detriment is that a static base period, which Minnesota uses, is being compared to a dynamic and ever-changing process. The term R&D evokes the very meaning of change, improvement for the better. A static measurement does not account for economic swings or improvements in efficiencies and research operations. Minnesota currently applies the static fixed base or percentage approach, which is similar to the regular or original research credit used by the IRS. There are 10 distinct steps to approach, which are cumbersome and complicated. I could go through the 10, but I will skip over them. If you have questions, I can go back to it. The federal government, following the elapsed time between 1988 and current years, in 2015, the federal government allowed for an elective, alternative, simplified credit. They had tried another method, and that's why I stumble over the name there. But the alternative simplified credit, and the reason that the feds did it was they recognized that the high base period, which is 1984 to 1988, would skew the calculation and fail to acknowledge the dynamic efficiencies in R&D spending today. Incomplete records from 84 to 88 made verification more difficult. Significant growth in current year R&D was not rewarded since it was tied to a static base period, and the complex history to maintain the base for acquisitions, mergers, and dispositions made it even more complicated and drove some companies out of taking the credit altogether. Now, the House File 3912 changes the complex 10 steps into really three. The first one is make the election. The second one is calculate your current qualified research expenses. And the third step is to take your three prior years of qualified research expenses and average them. And then from the average, reduce it by 50%. So that 50% of your three-year prior years is deducted from current qualified expenses, and the product of that is then what you apply your rate to. Much simpler than the 10 steps we had previously. Nothing has changed in the goals of the policy. It still incentivizes local and only local investment in employment. It incentivizes growth. It acknowledges the efficiencies of R&D today compared to what it would have been back in the mid-80s. And the competitive nature, I'll just go over three real quick. Large states that are they're known for developing hotspots for R&D. Texas has adopted the ASC. Its rate is 5%, but they have a kicker that can take it up to 6.25%. Massachusetts in 2015 adopted the alternative. The rate coming in was 5%. It will rise to 10% by the year 2021. And a little more closer to home, in 2014, Wisconsin established the ASC at a rate of 5.75%, but it was increased last year to 11.5%. Making these changes would make Minnesota significantly more competitive with the other jurisdictions that are competing for research investment. I am available for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from members. Chair Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, if you could expand a little bit near the end of your testimony, you referred to local, that the tax credit would be local in nature and generate employment in the state of Minnesota. And I've always supported this concept, but I think you said you were with 3M?
IBM.
Or you're with IBM. Okay. Well, that even fits my question more then, because 3M is here and a lot of the research is done right here in Minnesota. IBM, an international company. So research that's done in another state, would that qualify for the tax credit then with IBM when you use the term local?
Mr. Hyde.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. True, IBM is a very multinational company. I believe 3M is also a very multinational company as well, however. And 3M conducts a lot of research and development activity here in Minnesota. IBM in the Rochester area conducts a lot of research and development activity here in Minnesota. The credit that exists today and the credit that would be available under the alternative method is only measured by the activity that occurs here locally in Minnesota. So, for example, using IBM, we have research centers across the world. None of that research would impact positively or negatively the credit we would get in Minnesota. It's a very state-basic state-based calculation.
Then, Chair, may have a follow-up. That clarifies what you meant then by local. And the other question I would have then, the research often leads to the spinoff of other opportunities either within your company then or perhaps patents and so on even being sold perhaps to other companies. Do we benefit under this law then for the spinoff? And the reason I asked that question, Mr. Chairman, that was a few years ago, a big issue with the University of Minnesota. You know, they would they get their research dollars from a variety of pots, but the research would sometimes take place at the U of M and then sometimes even foreign investors. I remember a few years ago, three of their main patents went to Japanese companies, and that raised some concern here as to why Minnesota companies hadn't been able to access that research and those new products and what have you. So if you could comment then about what happens with IBM or this bill generally with the spin-off, the economic opportunities as new products are developed.
Mr. Hyde.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The activities that would be spun off or divested of any nature from any company would then leave the calculation completely. So IBM, if I were to sell off a patent to another party, there would be no qualified research expenses in IBM related to that product any longer. So it would not increase, I would not be able to take the benefit of that over and over and over again if I don't own it and I am not investing directly into it. If another party owns it and continues the research and development on it and does that in Minnesota, that party would have the opportunity to address and qualify for its own credit. But it would be totally on their activities. Once it is spun off, we no longer can use that information or the success of that product to further enhance our own R&D.
Chair Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that answers the question. I've always been supportive of these kinds of initiatives, and quite frankly, I referenced the U of M, the University Research Specials as well. But just wanted to make sure that if we're investing, that Minnesota is going to be the state that's benefiting, and it sounds like we are, so thank you.
Any other questions for members? Last word, Chair Anderson S.
Just thank you for your time, Mr. Chair.
And thank you. So Chair Anderson S. moves House File 3912 as amended, be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Anything else for the good of the order? I'd like to thank members for their work over this session so far. Got a lot more to do. With that, good government all the time. We are adjourned.